Welcome to the Playgroup Podcast.
Hear interesting interviews with LU's professionals and researchers.
Discover more playgroup stories and learn more about play, our well-being,
and lots of other fun stuff. We're recording live today at the Playlab.
Actually, developing children's imagination is at the same time developing their ability to think conceptually. And what's exciting about our work is that we focus on imagination, knowing that actually in the imaginary situations they can grow these amazing concepts, and that families can do it at home so easily, at the dinner table, in the car, out in the backyard. So our work is very much geared to everyday life and how everyday life can have a STEM lens to it and grow. But imagination is core.
Hi, I'm Miley Nauendorf, and this is the Playgroup Podcast. In our second episode, Sinead Halliday speaks to the team at Monash University's Conceptual Play Lab. There is so much great information in this interview, we've divided it into two parts. Join us now as we delve in to part one. To read more about this research and other Playgroup stories, visit playgroupblog.org.
I'm Marilyn Flynn. I'm Laureate Professor at Monash University.
I'm Gilgeria Fregevaki. I'm a Senior Research Fellow here in Mons University.
Hello, I'm Prabhat Rai. I'm Senior Research Fellow at Conceptual Play Lab, Monash University. Welcome to the Playgroup Podcast.
In 2018, Marilyn, you were awarded the Kathleen Fitzpatrick Fellowship. This has created vast opportunities to deepen our knowledge about the early years. Is this the first of its kind in the early years field?
We're so fortunate in the Monash and the Faculty of Education to have a conceptual play lab that's funded through the Australian Research Council to take forward the first of its kind research following children and families in relation to STEM, science, engineering, technology, mathematics. And it's a very prestigious grant that we've received for taking this work forward. The Australian Research Council is one of those organisations that has set up to fund research that's first of all approved by the experts in that area, and secondly, to have it at the laureate at the laureate level. So that's like the penultimate of the research pyramid, if you like. Is really positions this work in early childhood in a very important way in Australia. So it's a first of it for early childhood. It's a first for early childhood STEM. And it's a first worldwide, as far as I can tell. There are groups that are working in this space, but to have it recognised by the Australian government in this way is pretty exciting.
So this fellowship is hugely valuable in the form of funding, but you said yourself in resources, meaning people. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the team that you've assembled here?
Well, I recruited from overseas the brightest and the best, and they're here with me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to introduce them, and they can actually say a little bit about mm-hmm. themselves. So mm-hmm. perhaps we start with Glykeria.
Yes, of course. So that's true. I relocated from Greece especially for this project, and especially for work with Marilyn, who has a great background in early childhood education, of course. I think this is a really great opportunity for early years to start building on a great future. It's the first time that early years research is getting such a great grant opportunity, and we can build on that and create something new and great for early childhood education, for families, for children, etc.
And the other team member is Prabhat.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think just to add to what Lekere has said, it was so important for us when we heard about the study and Madeline has won this grant, because it is not just that it's happening in Australia for the first time, but it's also internationally leading in some ways, because we are doing foundational research in understanding how children develop concepts in early years. And there are very few and rare studies on trying to understand this over a period of time, and this over 4 years' time will have number of results and number of ideas which can be, you know, then brought back into the education system and can transform the early years education. And that's probably the motivating reason for me to move from India and for Dikaria to move from Greece to, you know, contribute to this fantastic work which Madeline is doing here.
Mm-hmm. And where are some of the other researchers from?
Well, what we are very excited by is that we also have six scholarship PhD students who are from New Zealand, Australia, someone who's just relocated from Hong Kong, and
China.
And also from the UK, one person who has a background from the UK. Mm-hmm. So that's in the immediate hub, but we have affiliates as well who are associated with our conceptual play lab. So we're from Nepal. We also have we had in the past some colleagues from Bangladesh. I'm just trying to think. We're very culturally diverse.
Yeah, in fact, we also have a lot of interest of people who are going to join us as visiting fellows from Finland, from Brazil. We have somebody at the moment. We are also going to get people from Norway, UK. So a lot of interest, and surely all of them also, I imagine, would contribute in not many ways. We learn from them to transform the Australian early years education system, and also how we engage in early years in families and in other settings, in other informal and formal settings.
So the theme is imagination in play and imagination in STEM, investigating how families and teachers create conditions for children's conceptual thinking in play-based settings. Can you tell us about the conceptual play lab you've set up here and how that works out in the real world?
Well, what we love to think about is that we have a conceptual play lab, but we also have the play lab out in the community. Mm-hmm. So it's, and because our work is very grounded in practices in family homes, in playgroups now, which is exciting, in childcare centres, in preschools, and we've also done some work in schools. So our living laboratory is actually out there in the community. So that's where we do our work. And conceptual play lab here at Monash University is very much grounded, is like the thinking space where we come together and work with our team to better understand what we're learning when we're out in our living laboratory. And one of the key things, you mentioned it as a theme, one of the key things that underpins everything we do is supporting this development of children's imagination. And why we do that is because imagination is loosely the creation of this imaginary world or imaginary situation that children enter into, and so they can take the broom from the cupboard and put it between their legs and ride around, and the broom handle becomes this horse. And so children are seeing a stick or a broom, but imagining it to be a horse in an imaginary situation of being out in the paddock or maybe in the backyard or wherever it might be. And so this is important because when children develop their imagination, in those contexts, we can actually work with them to develop their thinking in conceptual development. So the concepts of mathematics, the concepts around science or engineering, technology, and so on. So that's our focus, of course, but it could be literacy, it could be well-being, it could be any other thing as well. And we know from our research that if you take a stick as the example, and it becomes a horse, but a stick in school can be a ruler, and children are imagining a standard unit and doing measurement. So the reason for that example is to say that actually developing children's imagination is at the same time developing their ability to think conceptually. And what's exciting about our work is that we focus on imagination, knowing that that actually, in the imaginary situations, they can grow these amazing concepts, and that families can do it at home so easily, at the dinner table, in the car, out in the backyard. So our work is very much geared to everyday life and how everyday life can have a STEM lens to it and grow. But imagination is core.
So when we talk about play, we often talk about it as an aside. Why is it that play is so important, especially in the changing world that we're in?
So I'm just looking at the team to see if they want to respond to that. Do you want to talk about play world? Do you want to? Yeah?
Yes, okay. Of course.
So play is something that children under the... Well, actually all children, even adults, enjoy. But under the age of five, we know that this, their motive, their energy, their capacity to want to engage in the world is usually through a play lens. And as a community, of Australians who are so culturally diverse, we generally value that and try and create conditions that support children's play. When children are highly motivated to want to play, it means that you can change any situation through play, and children can learn through it. And this gives them inspiration to go forward. Now, in our work, we've created a model of play. It's an evidence-based model, which we've called Conceptual Play World, because what we've wanted to do is bring together this idea of imagination in play and imagination in learning. And our previous work has shown that this model works really well. But I'm going to hand it over to the team to talk a little bit more about what does that look like, and I'll give an example later.
So, in fact, to add to what you have said, Madeline, I think it's just to reiterate, in fact, the point that the way in which we're talking about imagination is because people have the tendency to talk about imagination generally in the fields where people are very creative. Artists have imagination, musicians have imagination. But we're talking about imagination in everyday life. So everybody in this world, when they are engaging in their everyday practices, are imagining and creating and co-creating a number of things. And children do the same, and probably just that they are doing a number of these things in their play worlds. I don't think anybody has seen a child not playing. Means you just keep a child in a... So my daughter generally comes to my office, and even when she reaches my office, a number of things which are around her, a pencil or a pen, that also becomes a kind of tool for her to design some new play for her. So it becomes a magic wand for her. So pencil becomes a magic wand. That's how children engage with the world. And that is something which is very central to the idea of conceptual play world. So on the one hand, this is what we understand is this is very central to the way in which children engage with their world. And that's where, and the other part of it is that children love to listen to stories. Right, so stories are something which are very central to children's everyday routine. You know, you talk to a child, and they will tell you a number of stories themselves, and they will also love to listen to a number of stories. So our model, the conceptual play world model, basically is trying to create a new space for children. We have designed. Madeline, in fact, has worked on designing a very interesting and new model, which. Can be used in early care centers. We have seen, we have evidence which shows that it works very well. We can design a play world, conceptual play world, which is basically moving between five stages. Step one could be selecting a very kind of nice story which has drama, which has tension, which has complexity, which has multiple characters, which can provide possibility for children to engage with the drama and tension in the story. Then the other stage, the second stage, is also to think around how can you design the imaginary space for children. Stage three is where I talk about entering and exiting the play worlds. And then you can also introduce interesting problems in that play world. And we also suggest that it might be helpful for the educator to think about what are different kinds of roles they can take in that imaginary situation. And I will hand over to Licaria then to maybe talk a bit more about it. And then Madeline can give an example maybe to explain.
So the core idea behind the model is to, instead of putting aside the children's strengths of imagination, play, and creativity, is to put it in the center and use these strengths in order to go forward through their engagement, learning, and development. So we are building these conceptual play worlds, and children can enter and exit this space and start be engaged with problematic situations, starting using concepts in order to solve these situations. And the educators are there, and the parents and the families are there to support the whole process and help the children be engaged, start learning, and be developed through their strengths, their main strengths. And these are actually the key assets that we have. And instead of, as you said, putting them aside, we choose to bring them into the surface and put them in the foreground.
And I'll give an example. So there's this beautiful story called Rosie's Walk, and by Pat Hutchins. So many of the families listening to this will know that story, but it could be any story.
Yeah.
This is a really beautiful, simple story, which can be made very complex or it can stay very simple. So in that story, for those listening who don't know it, it's about a hen who's going around the farmyard, and there is this fox that's chasing the hen, but the hen is completely oblivious to the fox. And so all these things happen when Rosie the hen goes around the haystack, the fox tries to jump on it and lands in the haystack and gets stuck. Or when it goes around the pond, the fox tries to jump onto the hen and lands in the pond and splashes everywhere and so on. So all these little things that are happening. But what's exciting for children is they can see in the story that that there is this tension, because they're feeling it, because they think, will the fox actually get the hen? No, this drama happens. Will the fox get the hen again? No. So there is this tension in the story, and that's exciting. Now, what we've done in our conceptual play world approach, our evidence-based model, is that we take a story like that, and families can read at playgroup, they can read that story to the children, or even tell it if they want, and have little objects cut out already, like a little picture, like take a photocopy of Rosie and put it on a bit of cardboard and have it as a little puppet, and a little bit of blue fabric down to be the pond, or some sticks and some grass to represent the haystack, etc. So they can tell this, they can read the story, or they can tell the story using the props very nicely. But then problems arise, and they have to be solved. But to set up this scenario, as Prabhat and Lakiria mentioned, we create an imaginary situation. So the children in the play, as part of the play world, can enter into Rosie's farmyard, and that becomes the imaginary play world. So even, and that could be just going from one room to another, where there might be a little sign that says Rosie's farmyard, and they can enter into that imaginary world altogether. So the children with the families all enter in. And or they can go outside if they're in a playgroup area where there's a nice outdoor area, and the outdoor area can be the farm. And so they're in the imaginary situation, and then some of the children will want to be Rosie, some of them will be some of the different characters that emerge, like there's bees in the story, there's of course the foxes, and of course foxes can be like an extended family of foxes, so you can have all of these amazing groups of children all pretending to be foxes. So they relive the story together, but the adults are part of it. So the adult can be the farmer, that's, so they've introduced some new characters. The adults can actually be one of the bees with the children and zoom around with them, trying to sting the fox away, as is the ending to the story. So there are all these amazing things that can happen in the imaginary play world. And then when you come out of the play world, you might set up a little problem that becomes like an activity for the play group. And so that might be, in one of the examples that we've done, this is where you can take your mobile phone and you can use your mobile phone to find fox sounds that can deepen the experience and create more drama. You know, oh, we can hear the fox coming, what are we going to do? We have to warn Rosie. We have to go back into the imaginary situation and warn Rosie. Mm-hmm. Or we could use the phone simply, you know, a little pre-recorded message that says, bah, 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 it's Rosie here, it's Rosie's cousin here, and I'm lost, I can't find the farm. And so this sets up a problem, and so, you know, the parents can play this at playgroup and say, oh, there's a message that's just been left for Rosie from Rosie's cousin, and what we have to help. How are we going to help? And so this means maybe making a map or looking at Google Earth and seeing where, you know, wherever the playgroup is housed, you know, going from big picture right down to the backyard through Google Earth. So that's a sort of an interesting way of using technology to enhance the program. But it doesn't have to be. It could be just that there's a letter that's arrived. And not that everyone uses letters very much these days. It could be a letter, or it could be a little package has arrived. It's probably more appropriate. There's a package arrived, and inside the package is an invitation, and there's a little problem that has to be solved or something. Come and visit or whatever. So that's about setting up a problem. But problems need to be solved, as Glykeria said. So they need concepts. So we learn about mapping. We look at all the different kinds of maps, and that might be Google Map, but it could also be very simply looking at, you know, pulling out a street map or wandering around the streets and thinking, how do you represent our playgroup in this street, in this community? Can we make little box constructions of it and put them on the floor and name them as the shop and all the other community features? And children taking little cars and saying how they got to playgroup that morning. You know, there are all those sorts of things that can come, and they're like little investigations or inquiries that you can really do nicely in a play world. And then that could be just sort of pops up for that day. But then next time when the children meet for playgroup, it could be that they come in and there's another message left with another problem that needs to be solved. So that's an example of a play world.
And I think that what we actually love more from this model that we have is that it's so flexible, and Marilyn just gave an excellent example of how it can look like, but at the same time it can take different options and be something really new and creative each time that we are using it. So it's a beautiful way of framing what parents and educators are doing in their everyday reality. It's a nice structure that it helps us to understand the whole process, but at the same time it is changing beautifully and take different perspectives, different concepts that can be engaged. So it's so beautiful. Never get bored of that.
No,
right?
Because every story, you know, that you select that has some drama to it can also be creatively rethought in relation to the kind of problems. But it's this entering into this imaginary play world together that the adults and the children can do that's so exciting and so different to the normal practices. So it's not about, you know, the children saying, Mum, Dad, come and play with me, or Grandma, come and play with me. It's actually about creating this imaginary play world together, and we all go into the imaginary situation and we meet these problems or we solve these problems. And our research has shown that this is so engaging and so exciting, and it's so meaningful to the children, because it builds on their strengths and their desire to want to play. And the adults can just sort of let go and be part of it and feel like they have a bit of a role, because they can stretch the children in different ways when they're playing together with them, because two adults can actually role play some concept, you know. And we've seen this in our research where adults have role played relationship between the moon and the earth, and where one adult pretends that they're the earth and the other one pretends they're the moon, and they sort of signal, here's Australia, you know, sort of pointing to one part of their body, and then looking to see, and then adding another adult in to look at where the sun is. And so something that's so abstract becomes so concrete in play, and children can be a part of that, you know, they can experience that and be with, you know, with the adults. So that's an example of introducing that very complex. For very young children in playgroup, you probably choose other kinds of problems, but it's still a very exciting way to work together with children.
And it is a wonderful way to incorporate and introduce technology, because the reality is we do live in a technological landscape. For many of us, there's screens all over the place in various aspects of our lives. But lots of parents have trepidation about screen time and how much is too much at an early age. So should we change this and maybe think about the quality of that screen time and what we do when we're using screens?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, and we'll probably all give a response to this, the example that I gave of Rosie's Walk, it shows how just an everyday reality and the everyday reality of the screen time, as you were saying about having the technologies in the environment, is actually drawn upon in a very purposeful way. So it becomes like it amplifies and excites and adds to the drama in a really meaningful way. So the focus is not the technology, the focus is the story for the children and for the adults, and the technology just enables something else to happen and something that's already characteristic of their world. So that's different to sort of putting the TV screen out and saying watch television or watch these digital watch these movies or whatever it might be, because my reading of the research in this space is that most of the research has been done on, first of all, most of the dramas around or worries around screen time have come from research that was around television viewing, so screen time and television, so they often don't discriminate. And my other understanding of the research is that it's also connected to how different apps and software were studied, but by the time the research paper comes out, those apps and software are no longer used. So because in the reality of research is it takes a long time for a paper to be published and so on. So it can be 2 or 3 years down the track. Well, technology moves so fast. Mm-hmm. So what you're reading about is no longer relevant for the moment. And a lot of it was prior to how very young children can pick up and use a handheld device to support them, because it enables, you know, my great excitement around these tools, and I always think of them as tools, is that they can become a magnifying glass for them, because actually it's easier to take your mobile phone, put it into camera mode, and or even video mode if you want to, and to really study a little ant and take an image of it as a little video or whatever it might be, or the looking closely at a flower or even the dirt. And if you give children in the past, you know, my experience with very young children is if you give them a hand lens, it's really hard for them to work out how to get their eye in relation to the magnification, and you know it's physically difficult. And even, you know, I'm sure the families who are listening to this can remember when they're in a secondary school and trying to focus on something under a microscope and having difficulty trying to actually see it. It's the same problem for very young children. So phone is so easy, so accessible, and it's always available because parents have them. And it becomes this amazing tool to study detail, and we know children love detail.
That's right. In fact, I quite agree with what Madeline is saying. And in fact, it's evidence-based, what you have just mentioned. As a parent, you know, and I have a 4-year-old daughter, I think the worries of a parent largely comes from 3 broad positions. One, that when the children are watching television or watching any, say, iPad, what it makes them is it makes them passive consumer of something what is offered to them. The second why is around eyes. Your eyes will go weak. You will have to wear a big specs. It's a very medical reason why you should be stopping children from watching television or iPads. And the third one is about they start living in those cartoons. So they don't live in the real world anymore. And these are three broad worries. I read papers and people just keep on talking about them. And I think it's basically trying to respond to the question of what Marilyn mentioned some time back is about this question of what is the purpose? What is the meaning because of which you are using technology? And it's not that children are not smart enough to see that. They are very much, as if you offer them a phone which can do all these different kinds of things, they keep on exploring more. Like I have a small Alexa device at home, and my daughter keeps going every day asking what kind of different questions to it. Her questions and all gets creative. I'm seeing like last 3 months, she asks all kinds of questions. The worry then people who writes on Alexa device and what Alexa can do to your child is that your child will basically get information what is there on the Google or it's kind of machine response. But she asks different questions every day. And sometimes she comes back saying that, oh, this device is stupid. Doesn't know any answer. So it's how the child is engaging with the device is a central question to me. And how the device or any technological tool is being used in family context or in early care centers context, which makes it, can transform reality. I'll give you a small example, just maybe picking up on Madeline's point of sun, the moon, and the earth. And we were having this conversation some time back, and it is so easy for me to show it on a screen that how you know the planets go around, and that image you just can't see otherwise, right? Technology can completely transport you to a different world altogether, which you just can't see with your own eyes, but she got a different lens to look at how these planets move around the sun, which you just can't show it to child anyway. So it basically helps them to understand something which is beyond their concrete world, and it's very helpful sometimes. It leads to a number of other conversations which you cannot imagine from your existing concrete resources. So I see technology as a kind of a transforming tool which can be very helpful and could be very meaningful in engaging with children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I adding to what Papa and Mary are saying, I think that it's always important to think about which are the criteria that we're using to make a choice. The criteria here probably for using technology is to expand and extend the child's reality, not to create a new reality, a fake, a technological reality and put the child in. So if the criteria is how can I use it in a creative way, so yes, of course, we can take that forward. Mm.
So if you're interested to participate in what we're doing, and we would love it if you say yes, you are interested, you can actually find out more information about us by just doing a search under the name of Flair's Conceptual Play World. And Flair is spelled F-L-E-E-R. So we hope to hear from you and hope you can explore our website and see what's there.
Thank you for listening to the Playgroup podcast. Tune in next time to catch the second part of this interview. For more information about Playgroup, head to www.playgroup.org.au. A big thanks to Marilyn and her team at Monash University for sharing their research with us. This interview was conducted by Sinead Halliday. Original music by Selena Byrne. Editing and mixing by Michael Wetter. This podcast is brought to you by Playgroup Victoria.